Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If we are all responsible for creating global climate change, who will take responsibility for fixing the problem before it's too late? Producer and correspondent Martin Smith traveled to 12 countries on four continents in search of the people and organizations with the power to change destructive consumption patterns. The result is a two-hour frontline documentary called Heat that debuts tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. We are pleased to have Martin Smith with us to talk about it. Martin, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So it becomes clear watching this that really nobody seems to think that it's their job to go at this problem.
Well, it's just too big, I guess. I mean, it's going to take a lot of effort by a lot of people. Business is going to do what it does, but it's finally, which is going after profits and competing, and nobody's going to make a move in the business world without a new playbook that affects all their competitors, because there's no advantage there. So it's going to take government. It's going to take huge political will.
The first scene, you take us to Mount Everest, basically, the Himalayas, and you've got this photograph taken in 1996, and then there's one compared to taken this year, and the difference really is startling.
It's actually from 1921. George Mallory, the British explorer, had gone up to Everest, and just a few years before he died on the mountain, he took a series of photographs of the glaciers. And we wanted to see in the intervening 85-plus years what had happened to that glacier. So I went with a friend and colleague, climber and filmmaker David Brashears, who spent a lot of time on Everest. He had been there last in 1996 and seen it. But the difference between the 1921 photograph and today is startling. It's lost almost half.
And this point comes up with people that, you know, yes, we've had climate change on Earth before and survived, but never at a time when the planet had to sustain 6.5 billion people.
Well, that's just it. It's there have been changes in the climate. I mean, our record from looking at ice cores goes back 650,000 years. We've never had as much carbon dioxide in the upper atmosphere in that period of time. But there's other evidence that suggests that there's been wild swings in the temperature of the planet. But we're living in a much more fragile time for the planet. We've stretched the resources, and we've got 6.5 billion people now. We're probably going to around 9 billion, I'm told, before we even have hope of turning things around or stopping that kind of growth.
So experts seem to think at this point that 60 to 80% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions needs to happen by the middle of the century, which we're talking 2050. At this point, though, we're still increasing output. Is that right?
We're increasing output, and we're increasing population, and we're increasing welfare gains, most importantly. I mean, you've got countries in the developing world where people are now getting their first cars. Soon they're going to have two-car families. I mean, they're going the way that the West, Japan, and developed countries have gone. And that is going to put a tremendous amount of more emissions into the atmosphere. And it's very hard to, at the same time, you have to cut emissions at the same time that people are consuming more, emitting more. So you really have to talk about entirely different energy systems that don't emit.
This, you know, it's so hard to look at this and be terrified by the fact that these people are finally getting cars and they're getting things that we don't even consider luxuries anymore, because it's frightening to think about that happening elsewhere. But the truth is, what they want is something that approximates an American lifestyle.
That's right. I mean, it's totally, I mean, there's, you know, we don't stand on solid ground to criticize them for those kinds of welfare gains. I mean, millions of people are emerging from poverty across India, across China. And the problem is, I mean, there's one startling statistic that if people in China continue to buy cars at the rate they're buying them, we're going to get to a point in not too many years, I mean, like 20 or 30 years, where China, if this were to happen, would be consuming all the world's oil. Well, obviously, that's an impossibility. So what it means is that over the next 20 to 30 years, we're going to have to see a radical redesign of the automobile and of transportation.
People who tend to be more optimistic about this have said China, in some ways, is in a great position to come of age right now because we understand the environmental consequences of growth, and they're in a position to set up infrastructure in a way that environmentally sound choices can be made and people don't even have to think about it. But it doesn't sound like you observe that happening.
Well, I think that's a good point, though. I think that's true. I mean, you just look at the cell phone. In many countries that were where people's first phones were cell phones, the cell phone service was better than it was in the U.S., where we had old infrastructure, we had confusing sort of interference patterns. I think that there is opportunity in China and India, but they're growing so fast. Of course, that's in some ways being affected by the global credit crunch. But you know, the long-term trend here is that they're going to continue to grow. So it's a problem.
A lot of people are looking at the economic slowdown right now and looking at consumption falling, and they're sort of hopeful about this. But we've seen this happen before, and certainly the change from the 70s into the 80s was not permanent.
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, the kinds of consumption that we've seen in the past, it has fallen because of economic slowdowns and because of high oil prices. And oil prices are not so high now. But the kinds of things that we've been experiencing here, it would seem to point toward less consumption of resources. But is there reason?
But it slows the growth in consumption. It doesn't. It's not like we go backwards. It's just that the steep curve that we're on just flattens a little bit. But we're still moving up. We're still consuming more.
Let's listen to a clip from the film. This is Heat, which will air tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13. This is dealing with the UN Climate Change Conference, and you have Paula Dobriansky representing the U.S. State Department in Bali.
For the first time, the developing countries stepped forward and said, we will negotiate verifiable, measurable, and reportable emissions reduction measures to be incorporated in the treaty. The developing countries called their bluff.
May I now call upon China?
And China was in the lead in saying we should do that.
We have all demonstrated the spirit of cooperation and compromise.
The U.S. negotiator said no.
I have to say that, you know, the formulation that has been put forward, we cannot accept.
Thank you. Thank you, United States.
And they were booed on the floor. And suddenly, Paula Dobriansky recognized that the story that was going to come out of Bali was that the United States destroyed a major climate agreement.
Oh, that's the United States who wishes to speak again.
So she sat there, flipped the microphone back on, shut the meeting down by saying we won't stand in the way of the consensus.
Let me say to you that we will go forward and join consensus in this today.
Who knows whether there was actual direct communication with the White House on that or not. The cell phones were going like crazy at the U.S. delegation table. But it was clearly, I think, in her negotiating instructions that, above all, don't let the United States get blamed for blowing up a deal.
That was a clip from the Frontline documentary Heat, produced by correspondent Martin Smith, who is with us to talk about the film right now. That was December of last year. Martin, what has happened since then with the U.S. and its negotiations on climate change?
Well, we're sort of in a holding pattern here because we're waiting for the next president. Now, there is going to be another conference, a world conference, to come up with a new climate treaty at the end of 2009, which gives the new president not a lot of time to act. The interesting background to that clip is that the United States had expected that developing countries were not going to come along, and that had been their position since Kyoto, and they were saying basically we're not going to do anything in the U.S. significant changes. Until the developing world comes on board. And so what you hear there is they call the bluff, as he says, and they call our bluff, and the United States is forced to shift positions. But it didn't really result in anything back in the U.S. Much. There's been a change in the you know, the midterm elections had committee chairmen changed in Washington, and that has changed somewhat. James Inhofe of Oklahoma is out at the Senate Environment Committee, one of the key committees in all of this, and Barbara Boxer, a California Democrat, came in. So you saw some changes, but basically most people in Washington are waiting for the Bush administration to clear the exits.
We are seeing some corporate entities that are embracing carbon regulations for the first time ever, including members of this group, the U.S. Climate Action Partnership. Can their intentions be trusted?
Well, there are businesses that have joined this effort, mostly because, as Jeff Ball points out in the film, the correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, they see the handwriting on the wall. It's not because they've suddenly seen the light and changed their positions on climate change. But they see that legislation is coming, and rather than they want a seat at the table, if they don't get a seat at the table, the expression goes, they'll be eaten for lunch. Now, that's one kind of business that sort of sees the writing on the wall. There's another that sees opportunity, that sees that maybe they can provide the new technology that is needed to reduce emissions. So there's a host of reasons that businesses are involved. Now, the U.S. Climate Action Partnership that you mentioned hasn't really, I mean, it's a stance by a number of businesses. It hasn't really resulted in any concrete action thus far.
What sort of tolerance do shareholders have for investing in cleaner technologies that might not pay back dividends except in the health of the planet, that might not put money in their bank accounts?
Well, that's right. If we all just keep going forward and expect, you know, to do whatever it is that makes us the most money in the short term, then we're not going to solve the problem, because this requires long-term investment, longer term than perhaps most people are accustomed to thinking. Shareholders, by and large, are interested in maintaining those dividends, but you are seeing some changes. With ExxonMobil, for instance, there was, at the last annual meeting, a shareholder resolution put forward by the descendants of the founder of the company, John D. Rockefeller, asking the company to think forward, think like an energy company rather than oil and gas company, and do more research, renewable energy research. And it got 27% support from the shareholders at large there at the meeting, which is an extraordinarily high tally for a dissident shareholder resolution, the kind of tally that gets management to pay attention.
You know, it looked a few months ago, Martin, like the only possible thing that we would be discussing in this election and in the term that followed it would be energy and the environment. And now with the environment, with the economic crisis, it really seems to have fallen by the wayside. Do you anticipate that whatever this next administration is will, in fact, make environmental policy a major focus?
Well, yeah, I think, I mean, they say they will. I have no way of knowing. And of course, none of us know quite what the fallout from this credit crunch is going to be. You know, day by day, we take a look at the markets and we take a look at the way that that Washington is talking about this. We just don't know.
Martin Smith is my guest. He is a correspondent and producer for PBS Frontline. His documentary Heat will air on Frontline tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. We will talk about things like coal and clean coal technology and what that all means. You're welcome to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
Most Americans don't have any idea that we still burn coal. They think of it as something that went out with, you know, top hats and corsets, and because they don't see it, because it's burned far away, and it just powers our lights. And we don't think about where that electricity comes from and what really goes on behind the light switch.
The facts are these. It takes 1 pound of coal to power your TV for 4.5 hours. Another pound to power your bedside light for 2 evenings. The average American household uses 9.5 tons of coal every year. 52% of all electricity consumed in America comes from coal.
That was a clip from Martin Smith's Frontline documentary, Heat. It will debut tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13 television. Martin Smith is with us for this conversation. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Really simple facts there, Martin, but things that I think will alarm a lot of people who aren't fully aware of just how much coal we're still burning in this country.
Yeah, I think that, you know, for a long time, I think that that was sort of the arrangement that the coal mining companies and the utilities sort of were comfortable with. They didn't really care if you knew where your electricity was coming from. I think you've seen a change now because they realize that climate change legislation is going to have a great impact on their business. And so they have mounted a major PR campaign, run a lot of advertisements. You see them a lot during the candidate debates in this last year. They've spent about $40 million in the last 12 months on raising awareness about coal. But until then, you're right. Most people didn't know that it was, you know, I have this image of like 9.5 tons of coal. If that's what an average family goes through, I'd like to see what that looks like on the front yard.
Yeah, piled up in the driveway or something.
Exactly.
Well, coal is such a difficult problem for us because it's cheap, it's plentiful in this country, and we hear so many people now, including Barack Obama, singing the praises of clean coal technology. What lyrics are left out of that song about clean coal?
Just one word, really, and that is cost. I guess there's another word, and that's feasibility. It's not so much the science of cleaning up coal that's a challenge. There are various processes that you can use to get CO2 separated out, and you can potentially then take that CO2 and bury it somewhere. The real issue is how much is it going to cost, and where are you going to put it? Not all parts of the country have the kind of geology that you need to bury it. There's also liability issues. If CO2 comes up through a fissure or some sort, it can kill people. It can asphyxiate them. It's not toxic in and of itself, but for instance, there was a natural occurrence of CO2 escaping from a lake in Central Africa a few years back, and it killed about 1,300 people. No states right now are even indemnifying utilities to allow them to bury this stuff. There's only one state, and you may know which it is. It's Texas, and that's the only state of the 50 that has actually come up with some kind of indemnification for the burial of CO2. But the candidates are talking about clean coal. The fact is it doesn't exist.
So it's a campaign phrase at this point.
Well, it's a campaign phrase. It's going to cost a lot of money to try it out. We don't really have any kind of program in place. The government had one, but they killed it. It's a long ways off. It's theory.
Well, and it's so interesting, Martin, because it's the other thing that comes up a lot in this election cycle in particular. Both sides are talking about, let's be straight, let's talk about these things in an honest way. But nobody wants to say out loud that we Americans might have to sacrifice some of the things that we have come to expect as our birthright.
Yeah, I mean, what we've been doing, of course, is using the skies as a dumping ground for waste. And it didn't seem to have any consequence, all that CO2 going into the atmosphere since the dawning of the Industrial Revolution really went up there for free, and it wasn't considered, anything that we had to worry about. Now we're being told that it is something we need to worry about, and we're going to have to pay in order to clean things up.
We should say that you have a really interesting bit of evidence that at least some scientists have understood the potential consequences of global warming for half a century now.
Well, you know, there was when I was in the seventh grade, we used to watch these films that were made by Bell Telephone science series, and they'd show these films. And there was a guy named Frank Baxter, Dr. Frank Baxter, who I remember well from my childhood when I watched these films. And I found this old clip that Baxter had done in one of these this popular TV show, one of his films, in which in 1958 he basically calls it. He says that if we continue to put CO2 into the atmosphere, it's going to warm things up and it's going to melt the polar ice caps. Well, that was 58. Now that's happening. So it's a pretty remarkable piece of footage that you can see in the first half hour of the film tonight.
The film starts at 8 on KERA Channel 13. It's called Heat, and it's a frontline documentary by Martin Smith. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Reeves in Dallas. Hi, Reeves.
Hi. I was going to mention my usual topic of objecting to the lawn care industry that uses the gasoline-powered equipment that's so destructive and noisy and polluting. But I want to applaud you on your understanding and discussion about how there really is no such thing as clean coal, aside from even the fact that they destroy the mountains and the streams up there. But I really wanted to ask you, in the Wall Street Journal on Monday was a little clip about Obama wanting to empower the EPA to address the lawn and garden equipment industries. And would it be possible that if McCain's elected, that that would also be addressed?
Well, I'm not familiar with the piece you're talking about, but this is to somehow that the EPA would have jurisdiction over the CO2 emissions from the lawn equipment?
I believe that's what she's talking about. Is that what you mean, Reeves?
Go ahead.
We'll assume for the sake of argument that that's what she was talking
about.
Well,
I mean, the Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, CO2 was a pollutant and that, therefore, the EPA has the right to regulate it. And that would be independent of whether you had Barack Obama or John McCain in the White House.
We have an email from Leonard in Arlington who says, the documentary tonight will most likely be viewed by people who already have an interest in the subject and the planet, and I believe this is a very small percentage of the population. The question is, how do you get the rest of the world to see this and to care?
Well, that's an excellent question. We do have a website at www.frontline.org. There has been quite a bit of money put into outreach. We're going to be putting together case studies to be used in business schools, and any schools will have access to teacher's guides. So this will be pushed into the schools and into universities to help stimulate discussion. We're always struggling in our business to try to reach those, you know, a broader audience. So I'm open to any ideas that the writer of that email has as to how to do that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Martin Smith is here. He produced a Frontline special that will run tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. It's called Heat. Let's go next to Mike in Arlington. Hello, Mike.
Hi. I may be a voice of one, but I would like to say that I believe the issue of greenhouse gas emission, of man-made global warming, is based on either poor or pop science. And the underlying goal is the redistribution of wealth. And thanks for hearing me.
Thanks for the call.
Well, you know, Frontline did a program a few years back called What's Up with the Weather that went, it was another two-hour program that looked at the science of climate change. And I know the producer of that program, and he went in as a skeptic and he came out as a believer that indeed there was a problem here. I understand the caller's suspicion that this has something to do with the redistribution of wealth or that this is somehow the environmentalist's revenge, but I think it's not a small group of scientists who are sounding these alarms. We decided to take a look at this as a business story, not as a science story, so that's not the primary focus of the program tonight. We're looking at what are these businesses going to do now that the argument really has been settled. And it's my belief that after looking at this, that as much as I would like to think that it's still an open question, it doesn't appear to be. I think we have to get on with this as a societal and a business and government problem.
What sorts of corporate entities influence federal policy on greenhouse gas emissions? Of course, we know big oil and energy, but there are other industries as well.
There's the, the third largest emitter of CO2, the third largest industrial source of CO2 was a big surprise to me, and that is the cement industry. And, of course, that's big everywhere, but it's especially big in the developing world where you're having massive build-out of airports and highways and buildings and whatnot. And there's no known way to reduce those emissions. There's no electric car solution, for instance, there. And then there are other industrial processes of all types. But the big ones are transportation, using oil, and the burning of coal to make electricity.
So there are some states trying to take matters into their own hands, including California, where Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has set a goal of cutting all greenhouse gas emissions in the state by 90% by about 2050. Let's listen to what happened to his proposed regulations.
The auto business has always had a love-hate relationship with California. Obviously, they love the fact that we're the biggest car market on Earth. They hate the fact that we try to regulate what comes out of their tailpipes.
But overall, we've had a very cooperative relationship. And frankly, I was taken aback when I found out that the industry was not only not prepared to be cooperative, but that they were determined to fight us in every possible arena.
The stakes were very high. 18 other states had adopted or were considering the California standards. But to make it law, California needed a ruling from the EPA to allow the state to set stricter fuel efficiency standards than the federal government.
We still have to go to the Bush administration to get what's called a waiver from the Clean Air Act to go ahead and implement those regulations. And the car companies have lobbied strenuously, successfully, with the Bush administration to prevent us from doing that.
They lobbied not only the EPA, but they lobbied Congress, they lobbied the White House, they lobbied the Transportation Department. The U.S. Transportation Department was caught red-handed actually trying to line up members of Congress to lobby the EPA.
These internal Department of Transportation documents show that more than 70 congressmen and governors were called by department officials and warned that an EPA waiver could have significant impacts on the car industry. Congressman Dingell proposed a law to make California's waiver request illegal. There were also several key visits to the White House by car company executives.
This was an all-out war by the car industry against California.
In December 2007, the EPA denied California's waiver.
So, in effect, Martin, what happened was that the Clean Air Act was used to block California's efforts to make the air cleaner.
Yeah, that's one way to put it, exactly.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Louisville. Hello, Jim.
Hello. I want to compliment you for a program that's really important, and I have a couple of comments to make. One, concerning what this is all about as opposed to the redistribution of wealth, is a bunch of things that you already know about. National security, as has been pointed out, at the current price of oil, it's around $400 billion that we're transferring to foreign countries, some of them not our friends. For the pollution that's right here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, ozone days that causes me to have to stay home and other people that have problems, hasn't been in compliance since 1990, and vehicles are 60-some percent of the problem, and a few other things like that. So, for example, even the economy, that being more efficient, we're more competitive globally. And the second point that bothers me a lot, I've been studying just the petroleum side of it now for a long time, and China and India and the growing economies, we have to provide leadership. Currently, I know they get a lot of blame, but we use 25% of the oil at 4% of the population, which means that on a per capita basis, that's 12 and a half times as much as China and 25 times as much as India. So if we think about parity, the world's going to be in a lot of trouble.
That's right.
We
that's
do
exactly
something
right.
to bring it down. So That's my comments.
Thanks for your call.
That's exactly right. I mean, the fact is, though, that we're rich and we are technological leaders, and the rest of the world, even if they wanted to address some of these things, is hamstrung. They have their own problems. They have their rapid growth rates. It's, as the caller points out, the United States is the big consumer, and the United States is going to have to show the way technologically if these things are going to be addressed. That's the consensus view of all the people that I spoke to.
Martin, it seems that many Americans wouldn't like to think of ourselves as people who consider ourselves as being worth more than anyone else on the planet. And yet there is that number that we hear over and over and over about consuming 25% of the world's energy resources and having 5% of the world's population. Do you think our ability to sort of ignore that reality has to do with our geographic isolation, or what's at play here?
Well, there have been people in the U.S., I mean, politicians who have said basically the U.S. lifestyle is not up for negotiation. But I think that we're simply ahead of the curve is what it is. I mean, we just were there first, Europe, America, Japan, in terms of exploiting these fossil fuel resources. The sort of tragedy of it is that we were able to profit enormously from exploiting these cheap energy sources, and now we're discovering there's a problem and are trying to tell the rest of the world you can't come along the same path as we're going on. And so they're looking back at us and saying, well, fine, but we have a right to a better living, so help us figure out, you know, cleaner energy sources, how to sequester coal, carbon dioxide from the burning of coal, or electric car technology, whatever it might be. The people are looking to us.
We will talk with Martin Smith in a moment about what happened when he went to test out the Chevy Volt, the electric car that has been proposed here in this country. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We're talking about Heat, the Frontline documentary that airs tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is producer and correspondent Martin Smith. His new documentary for Frontline, called Heat, debuts tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So with all the talk about peak oil and the limitation of the supplies of fossil fuels that we do now have, one would think there would be great money in the future investments in new technologies. But there hasn't been as much as we might have hoped. And you went to test the Chevy Volt sometime back. Can you talk about what happened?
Yeah, General Motors invited us along with our cameras. They were doing a publicity shoot to get some shots of their new their prototype for their new electric car. And so we were happy to go along and see what that was like. And it was rather shocking. Usually if you ask somebody into your house and you're going to show your dog show them your dog doing new tricks, you want to make sure that the dog knows those tricks. But they really hadn't done much of this, and the car didn't perform well at all in front of our cameras, or their cameras, for that matter. And the shoot was quickly canceled. The car could barely make it up a small hill, and then I ended up having to help them push it to get it back into the trailer. So it doesn't speak well for the future. Now, they've put billions of dollars into it, and to be fair, this may be a huge success. We don't know. It's going to hit the markets in another year or so, and it's going to cost about $40,000. We don't know what the market will be for it, but they're putting a lot of effort into it. It's just that they are still, at least at that time, they were pretty far behind.
Is the net energy use of an electric car significantly below the net energy use of an oil-powered car?
Well, sure. It's the problem is, where is the electricity coming from?
Coal in most cases, right?
So 50% of our electricity and more or more is coming from coal. So that means the Chevy Volt's going to be running on coal.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jonathan in Dallas. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Chris. Thank you for the show. And Martin, thank you for your efforts with Frontline. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
My comment really surrounds, firstly, around coal, and I want to touch on the electric car issue that's been rightly brought up in association with this. First of all, it's very important, in my opinion, that people understand that when we talk about clean coal, we're talking really about burning the coal. And while it may be technologically possible for us to incinerate coal and extract the energy from it, what's not possible is for us to get it out of the ground in a clean fashion. And what we are doing with surface mining and strip mining is really a terrible word to use, but we're raping the face of our nation. I'm a son of Appalachia and very proud of that fact, and it's not a good thing to go and see entire mountains removed and destroyed as the result of our search for energy, cheap energy. And the second comment I wanted to make would be regarding the electric car, the Chevy Volt, and others. And that is, I have some real questions about how it is that we came to lose the Chevy EV1 in the 90s. It seems very suspicious, and it seems something doesn't compute that we would have a viable vehicle from a functionality standpoint, although perhaps abbreviated functionality. And then take a few steps backwards in 10 years to get a Chevy Volt, which apparently isn't as far along as even a car was 10 years ago using old technology. And so there is a movie on this subject called Who Killed the Electric Car?
Well, and in fact, Jonathan, I'm so glad you called, because this actually comes up in the film.
That's right. You've got it right. I mean, they had an effort back in the 90s to make an electric car, and they came out with the EV1, and it was in response to a California mandate that a certain number, a percentage of the cars they sold in the state had to be zero emission. And so they went to, General Motors went down this path and made a pretty good car. And then, of course, what happened was that the mandate was loosened, and so General Motors abandoned the project. And the big money was really in big gas-guzzling cars, because gas was cheap. So that whole project sort of went by the wayside. And I ask in the film that you see tonight, I ask General Motors why they had to crush them. And she said it was the VP of the environment there said it was a recycling program that didn't work out. Well, the problem was with the batteries. And that continues to be the problem with the Volt. They don't have a sort of safe battery yet that will operate. And they didn't for the EV1, and they don't for the Volt.
By the way, when you say crush them, for people who aren't familiar with the film, they actually took them and smashed them up so that nobody could use the cars that were actually produced.
That's right. They took them out in the desert. There are scenes of those that sort of area in the desert where all these crushed cars are stacked up at a General Motors facility out in the California desert. It's pretty remarkable.
Martin Smith is my guest. The Frontline documentary that he produced is called Heat. It's on tonight at 8 o'clock on KERA Channel 13. Let's speak next to Kenneth in Dallas. Hello, Kenneth.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call. I just wanted to kind of touch base again on the redistribution of wealth issue. I just had a quick comment. I'm a fairly conservative, independent voter, kind of undecided still. But regardless whether or not global warming is a man-made phenomenon or an Earth event, we owe it to our grandchildren to try whatever we can to stay on the planet as long as we can. And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, hang on one second, Kenneth. Before we let you go, you said you're undecided. Is environmental policy one of the things that will tip the balance for you?
Of course. Yes, it will. It's just the amount of time that I've been voting conservative. To be honest with you, I'm like a dog with a frisbee. I just don't want to let go.
All right. Well, I appreciate
your
call.
Good luck. Good luck in the coming weeks making your decision.
Are you hearing from people like Martin like Kenneth Martin as you work on your project? Do you find people that really have sort of come around to this idea and now think, regardless of where your politics lie, this is something that we can all coalesce on?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think although we had great optimism in the beginning of the year that there was going to be progress on the climate front, on addressing climate change. And once gas prices started to go through the roof, that kind of got washed away, and we ended up chanting drill, baby, drill at the Republican National Convention. So while there was a lot of optimism and a lot of togetherness on this issue in the beginning of the year, it kind of quickly evaporated. So that's a bit discouraging.
Let's go next to Sean in Plano. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Martin, I just want to say thank you so much for your work on Frontline. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
My question is this. With all of the evidence we have now, you know, regardless of what your policy beliefs are, with all the evidence that we have now, my question is, what is the root cause of this minutia that prevents the world from just putting aside the past and moving forward and developing energy resources that are renewable, that are friendly to the environment? Is it ignorance? Is it just denial, or is it just the almighty dollar? It just seems like it's such a no-brainer for governments and for private industry just to say, we have got to do this and to move forward. Why is it such a fight?
You know, I think it's about inertia. I think we have a way of doing things that has worked for us for 100-plus years. We've built out big energy grids. We've had cheap gasoline. We've had cheap coal. And these things have worked for us. So more than anything, I think it's both it's political inertia, and it's the power of special interests to keep business as usual in place.
We have an email from Victor in Fort Worth who says, would you comment on the differences in approach to the problems being discussed today between U.S., Japanese, and European automakers? Are there fundamental differences?
Well, there are big differences in that those countries have been far more proactive in subsidizing renewable energy sources. And when it comes to automobiles, the Europeans and the Japanese didn't have built smaller cars, but they did that because they didn't have cheap oil. The United States is a country that sits on, or sat, as one person put it to me, vast quantities of oil. And even when that oil began to run out, we were able to go abroad and get cheap oil. So we built our cars accordingly, and based on the addiction that we had, because we had so much cheap oil to begin with. Japan and in Europe didn't have that. They're very aware of being cut off from their sources, and so from the get-go, they built smaller.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Dwayne in Duncanville. Hey, Dwayne.
Hey. I just wanted to make a comment about the U.S. being 5% of the population and producing 25% of the carbon emissions. That's true. I want to caution us not to do a lot of self-flagellation. Although we are 5% of the population, we produce an immense amount of percentage of the manufactured goods in the world. And that's probably why we're producing the carbon emissions we are, is because we're producing a vast quantity of the world's goods. And when you compare perhaps the percentage of pollutants we make compared to what we manufacture, we're probably one of the more or the most efficient country in the world, say, compared to what China produces as opposed to pollutes. I just wanted to make that comment, that we don't get too self-flagellant about this.
No, I think that's a valid point. Look, it's in human nature to consume and to improve our station in life. And it's not that the rest of the world is sitting around like a bunch of angels, consuming less because it's somehow better for the planet, and that we're doing it because we're just pigs. It's all human nature. We are simply, us, Europe, Japan, are countries that have had economic booms before the rest of the world. We are, therefore, the developed world, and they are developing. But there's nothing, as the caller points out, there's nothing, I don't think we should be punishing ourselves for this. I don't think there's anything to be gained in that. I think we have to all get together and be rational about this and figure out how we're going to dig ourselves out of the problems that we're in.
I guess part of the issue is that most of us view it as punitive to have to change the way we live, to have to consume less, to have to watch our energy consumption.
Well, I think that's why you don't hear a lot on the campaign trail, because in fact, there is going to be a cost to this. I mean, there are going to be constraints. You're either going to pay more for your electricity or for your vehicle or for all the manufactured goods that you use that are made with electricity or with gasoline. Prices of things are going to go up because, as I was pointing out earlier, we've been using the skies as a free dump. Now we're going to have to pay in some way, shape, or form for what we've been disposing of for free. We're hearing on the campaign trail about green jobs and opportunities, and while some of that is true, what you're not hearing about is the cost. And it's just in our nature that we don't want to kind of go step back. So we have to think, and I don't think we have to go back and sit in the dark. I think we can have growth and we can have more wealth, but we have to figure out how to do it in much more intelligently than what we are doing now.
If we keep things very brief, we have time for one more phone call, and that comes from Mark in Bedford. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'll be brief. And I'm just curious, in the documentary tonight, I'll be looking for any information about adopting a vegan or vegetarian lifestyle. I'm stunned that no one talks about it, to include Al Gore. It's the single biggest thing we can each do individually. The UN has reported this. It's in Time magazine last month. But no one's talking about it.
I'm very aware of this, and I think it is an issue. And I think you won't find this in this documentary, and there are a number of things that you won't. It's 2 hours. But the consumption of meat has a footprint significantly greater than that of a vegetarian lifestyle. If you're trying to get people to pay attention to this issue, I'm not sure that's the best place to start. But I saw that PETA, came out in favor of trying to push Al Gore to take this on. I think that that's a hard road to hoe at this point.
I've read that you have said, Martin, you've worked reporting on the Cold War, the breakup of the Soviet Union, the rise of Al-Qaeda, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but nothing matches climate change for you in terms of scope and severity.
Well, it's the entire planet. It's our way of life. It's everything. It's everything we consume. It's everything we do. So while the crises, the wars on two fronts that we face, the global credit crunch, all this stuff pales in importance to climate change.
Well, you can see the Frontline documentary Heat debuts tonight at 8 on KERA Channel 13 television. Martin Smith is a producer and correspondent. Martin, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Chris, thanks very much.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.